Welcome to the podcast on innovation and digital anthropology. This podcast is being brought to you by the Live Center and myself, Matt Arts. The Live Center is a nonprofit advancing how the world understands people in the digital age. The team at the Live Center, in partnership with UNESCO, is working to advance education, technology, and awareness for innovation in digital anthropology as a force for good across the public and private sectors. To help accomplish that goal, we have created this podcast in which we will explore the latest research and perspectives on innovation in digital anthropology. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the UNESCO and Live podcast. Today, I'm talking with Simon Dara and Isabel Cotton on the new about the New Horizons in Digital Anthropology report that has recently been put together. We'll be talking about essentially the landscape of digital anthropology globally, how the report came together, of course, some of the findings and recommendations. And so Simon and Isabel are both director and co-founder at the Digital Behavior Lab. And so I welcome you both to the podcast today. Thanks for putting the report together. Thanks for joining us. Simon, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. I'd love to. And first of all, thanks for having us today. It's brilliant to talk about the report. My involvement in anthropology has come late in my career. For many years, I was the head of international advertising at The Guardian newspaper and website in the UK. I spent a long time working in advertising, advertising sales in The Guardian and various other companies as well. Where I met Izzy was at University College London, where we both studied for a master's degree in digital anthropology. So it was an abrupt change, I guess, you might say on my CV. It looks like, you know, you've done one thing for a whole career and then gone into anthropology. But actually, the two things are very connected. If you do business globally, and you work cross-border, you do cross-border business activity, you will notice the differences between cultures, business cultures around the world. And I always found that really, really fascinating. And so I thought, you know, for example, if you do a meeting in Italy with, say, a big fashion advertiser, one of the things I used to do, a big fashion advertiser, and the behavior in those meetings is completely different to behavior that you would have at a meeting in Japan or Singapore. And that culturally centered difference, which I found really, really fascinating. And I wanted to understand it. And I thought, in the digital age, this is what I need to be understanding now. I've seen evidence of it. I've lived it. And I want to understand what it all means. And so that was my route into digital anthropology. And then the founding of DBL, Digital Behavior Lab, with Izzy, after we met on the course.
Cool. Great. Thanks. And Isabel?
Yeah, so I'm Isabel. You can also call me Izzy, as Simon's been calling me. I'm also a digital anthropologist. I actually first discovered digital anthropology during my undergrad. So I remember reading the work of Dana Boyd when she was, I think it was a work of research about MySpace. And I remember thinking, like, wow, this is someone who's studying people like me, like what I was doing when I was 12, 13 years old. And I was really fascinated by this idea of studying these kind of online, very unique communities. So that was kind of my entryway in. And then, as Simon has been saying, we then did the master's in digital anthropology at UCL. That was back in 2019, I believe.
Long time ago now, yeah.
Quite a while ago. We finished during the pandemic, so it was a very unique time and a very kind of fitting time, actually, to be studying digital anthropology when the world kind of became digital out of necessity. And then we put together Digital Behavior Lab after we completed our studies with some of our other colleagues from the course. And what's interesting is that essentially Digital Behavior Lab is a digital anthropology agency, but as is probably the case with a lot of anthropology agencies, it's a very fluid and kind of reflexive organization. So we've changed a lot in how we operate and what kind of things we're interested in. So when we first started, we were really interested in how businesses were being affected by the pandemic. So all of these agencies, even companies, even schools, so like UCL itself, how they were being impacted by this kind of forced shift into the digital. So that was kind of our original idea of how we could really fit in. But then as time has kind of progressed, we've kind of shifted and changed and understood where better we can place ourselves. And I think what was nice about, I'm sure we'll go into it, this project with UNESCO was it kind of shed a new light on how we could be helpful in the sense that speaking to individuals at UNESCO really kind of highlighted how different everyone sees the digital and how, based on kind of what your existing kind of circles are, you'll see in a completely different way. So we were really like, wow, okay, there's a really great opportunity here to bridge the gaps between kind of a more academic understanding of anthropology, digital anthropology, and like a business or more kind of, more universal understanding of digital anthropology. And that is kind of where we're sitting today in this kind of, we have this desire to bridge the kind of gap. And what's really nice is about this report is that that is what it's kind of all about. It's about making digital anthropology accessible and making it kind of universal. So it really fit kind of nicely into where we were already heading as an agency, which was great.
And how did you come into the report? How did you get involved?
So we originally saw a just a brief posted by the Live Center that they were looking for anthropologists or people who worked in the anthropological field to participate in putting together. This was originally the regional report. So to give you a bit of background on kind of how this final report was put together, the first stage was actually four regional reports. So there were four kind of experts, although Simon and I were together as one as DBL as the expert, putting together four individual reports. And the regions, our region was Europe and North America. The other regions, Simon, you might have to help me here. It was Africa and Middle East was the other region.
Latin America and South America and the Caribbean and then Asia.
So there was four regional reports, and then those were put together originally with some really fantastic researchers. And based off of those, we were able to put together the final landscape report, which is what we're speaking about today.
Yeah, great. Thanks. And so there's a number of findings in there, nine major findings, I'll say. There's many more findings, I guess, but nine major that you kind of pulled out. I'm not going to go, necessarily in all of them today, but there's a couple that I found interesting. So one was the state of transition. Another was on sort of the regional nuances, as it relates to maybe the regional reports you just spoke of. The intersection of anthropology and data science, and the fact that digital anthropology is really at the beginning of its journey. So, maybe if you wouldn't mind, could you just elaborate on what you mean by sort of like the state of transition?
So what we noticed in putting together the kind of different data sets and data sources from the regional reports, and when we tried to visualize them, we started kind of seeing them as mapped on kind of a diagram. And so we had on the left-hand side of this diagram, which you can actually see in the report, we had a bubble of what we call doing anthropology digitally. And so this space was characterized by the migration of anthropological practices into digital environments and using digital tools. And this makes a lot of sense because it emerged in response to the digital revolution that began in the 1980s. So this is kind of like the first wave of digital anthropology. And a lot of this was happening in academia, and it kind of remained in academia. And then what we started to see was there was this movement of anthropology away from this kind of very like pure academic iteration into a more applied anthropology. So this was when we were seeing it more in the private sector and in the public sector. And this was in our minds more related to doing the digital anthropologically. So this space was more characterized by the anthropological response to the global infatuation with the digital. This was following the big data and data science revolution in the mid to late 2000s. And so a lot of this, as I said already, a lot of the movement in this space was happening in the private sector. So Microsoft Research, for example, was employing digital anthropologists like Dana Boyd and Kate Crawford. And this is all very exciting. This kind of transition towards this more applied anthropology. But what we noticed was actually what's happening now and where the kind of really interesting innovation is happening is in between these two spaces. So in the kind of liminal space in between and the individuals who kind of sit in between academia and the private and public sphere. And what we noticed was also there was this academic to private pipeline. So there was this common trajectory of individuals who would start off in academia before starting their own agency or starting to freelance for companies like Microsoft, and kind of sitting in between the two in this kind of liminal space. And that was where a lot of the kind of key innovators that we noticed were coming from.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, some that, as you said, there's some really key innovators there. I mean, people like Sarah Pink, who I think obviously you know. I understand Sarah Pink, and that's her with her emerging technology lab at Monash, and as Christian Munk in Aalborg University with his with TANT. These are the real the people who are really, really sort of moving things forward by inhabiting that. That's between space, the kind of where computational anthropology and all those kind of new techniques are emerging and being applied. That's where that's where the action is. We've had these two sets of how anthropology has been done historically, both academically and in applied terms. But now the real action, the real innovation, the real applied stuff, which is based around problem solving. See, that's the issue, I think, here. It's about solving real life problems. The work that Sarah Pink's organization does is funded by government, and it involves the private sector as well as academia. It's got that triad of influences and stakeholders, if you like. But it really is about solving real life and real time problems. So I think that's where when we're talking about the transition, that's the transition that we're talking about, that we noticed we picked up when we started our research, and we were unaware of it beforehand. We lived in our own little we're our own little bubble, it's that's in London, at UCL, trained by in a very traditional, but very effective way by the likes of Daniel Miller. But we were in isolation, and it's very interesting for us to see the regional differences and regional nuances, which I think was something you picked up on as well.
Yeah, so could you, so thanks for sharing all that. Would you mind elaborating a little bit on the regional differences that you picked up on?
If you think about anthropology, the history of anthropology, it is a discipline rooted very firmly in the global north, in the UK and primarily the UK and the US. Each of those traditions have their own nuances, their own styles, their own areas of interest. But it very much was it's a discipline that's very much rooted in that part of the world. And it would be a mistake for us to assume that anthropology means the same things around the world as it does to the US and to the UK. It doesn't even mean the same thing in the US as it does in the UK. So it's no great surprise then that it means something very different in Africa. I mean, you take Africa as a good example. In Africa, anthropology follows very much, or the appreciation, the understanding, the use of anthropology is based very much on its history. It was seen initially as a cultural imposition. It's the study of, of others. to enforce the idea of both their alterity, but also their inferiority. So it has, it was part of the colonial project, which you know, defined who was the who had the power and who did not. Now, obviously, anthropology, the appreciation of anthropology has gone through changes in Africa, but still, it's not, it has a very, very different history to that of Western Europe, for example. But then, when you look at somewhere like Asia, it's seen in a different way. Anthropology departments at universities are kind of subsumed under sort of media and communications departments, that kind of thing. Where anthropology, you know, it's the science that dare not speak its name. It's almost hidden. The processes, the methodologies are used, but they're not called. It's not called anthropology, and it is in some instances, but it's rather less so than in other places. So it's not seen as a. There is a more of an understanding of solutions to societal problems being delivered by data, hard data, for example. So a techno-solutionist kind of approach, rather than a softer. Social science kind of approach. So anthropology, although it does exist, it exists under different names, under different guises, and then does different things in Asia to what it does in. I'd say Australia, by the way, is an exception in that region, because that's very much follows the European and US model. And of course the real action, because the real funding and the real, you know, history of anthropology exists in Europe and North America. So one thing that we had to do was to get our heads around the idea that just because we see anthropology in a certain light, in a certain way, and that it has served a certain purpose and can be used to do certain things, that's not necessarily how it's seen around the rest of the world. And that's not necessarily where, doesn't necessarily mean that innovation in anthropology only exists on the European or US model. That's not the case. And if we don't recognise that, then we fall victim to our own the prejudices of the discipline, which, you know, influenced its development over, you know, the last century or so.
Yeah, I think that was actually one of my kind of favourite takeaways from doing the landscape report. Which, yeah, as you're mentioning, like, there's this element of how much are we losing just from a lack of shared vocabulary within the anthropological discipline? Because as we were reading the regional reports and as we were doing our own kind of research, we were realizing, hold on, like, a lot of people are talking about doing the same things, but just using very different language. And so one of our kind of key takeaways or potential ways to kind of move forward and create more of an anthropological thinking world is to just find a way to have some kind of shared sense of a shared vocabulary. What could be gained simply by doing that? And it also kind of safeguards against, as Simon was mentioning, this idea of anthropology and now digital anthropology continuing to be a Western export to the rest of the world, which is something that is, yeah, obviously historically rooted in the discipline of anthropology, and something that should really be at the forefront of this new iteration of applied anthropology and applied digital anthropology. That's something that was really important to us as we were putting together the report.
So building on actually what you both just said, I guess I have two questions. And tying it back to the liminal space and the diagram that's in the report, which I appreciate the listeners can't see right now, but they'll all see it in the near future. So maybe first on the different terms. So in this, you know, in this diagram, there's techno-anthropology and digital anthropology. How are, you know, different groups sort of using those terms, and how do you see them being similar or different?
Interesting. Yeah, so techno-anthropology is interesting in the sense that it was really coming out of Denmark. So there's a big movement around the TANT, the techno-anthropological lab in Denmark. Is that the name, Simon? Techno-anthropological. With Anders Christian Munk, he's like the leader of this kind of movement within Denmark. And everything coming out of there is really fascinating. It's rooted in this very reflexive way of dealing with technology. So it's about using technology, but also questioning it from an anthropological perspective at the same time. And similarly, a lot of work within digital anthropology in the UK and in Australia, a similar kind of methodology is happening where it's equally about using tech but also questioning tech. So what's interesting about that liminal space is a lot of the terms there are actually, as we've hinted at, using very similar methodologies, but just calling it different things. And yeah, that kind of points again to the importance of having this shared vocabulary, so that we can kind of avoid or at least make more transparent this very like messy web of influences that we've also highlighted in the report, just to kind of make sure that recognition is being given where it's due, and also that we're kind of building a bigger, that we're building upon each other's work rather than kind of working on the same things in silos.
Thanks. And now another interesting thing though is, so in that, again, that liminal space of the diagram, we have techno-anthropology, blended algorithms, computational anthropology, digital anthropology. It does seem from my understanding of the landscape, both like, reading your report and my own sort of understanding coming into this, that those are actually things that are sort of, global north being exported very much. And while I find that space interesting and do some work in there myself, I'm wondering also, is there anything else you found, in any of the regional reports that is some kind of blend of, of the other spaces?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the thing that comes to mind, first of all, unfortunately, it's from a UK-based initiative, but operating in certain countries in Africa. And it was really kind of inspiring to us as a reminder that the digital and digital anthropology doesn't necessarily have to be this really technical thing like coding or computational science. And it's an organization called,
Excites.
Excites. So it's an organization called Excites, and it's set up by UCL, actually. It's an initiative from UCL. And they essentially provide quite like basic mapping tools that is. They're offered like training for citizens within countries they're researching within to use these quite basic tools. And it's all about the kind of methodology behind it is citizen journaling. So it's about making individuals, giving them kind of the power to do research on themselves and giving them the opportunity to be storytellers of their own narrative and their own experiences while also collecting data and conducting research on their communities. So it's this really beautiful way of kind of kind of making this form of social research far more accessible. And stripping back a lot of the kind of academic language and those kind of barriers.
Jumping in, there's one of the recommendations that comes out of this report is that is about raising global awareness and all that kind of thing. But it is also very conscious that we're not exporting complex digital methodologies from the global north or the global south. That it should look more like sort of bottom up, scalable approaches that look at local, address local needs. And I think the idea of recentering community agency in research, because I think historically it might have been seen as a kind of as an extractive process, taking out. Okay, anthropology takes that; it takes knowledge out from its studies, even however empathetically it might study a situation, an assemblage, a society, a culture, whatever it might be. It naturally is extractive. It takes stuff out. It doesn't necessarily give anything back. And the idea here is that as part of this global initiative to develop innovation in digital innovation in anthropology is to center it very much on local needs and to empower local people to give them the tools to solve their own local problems. And I think that this idea of and which requires, again, in order to not be extractive, you don't go in, no matter how, you know, your participant observation was a key tool in traditional anthropology, where you sit, literally sit in a with a community of people who you're studying over time, and over time develop an understanding of their view of the world from their perspective, because you're part, you're with them, you're part of them, you're part of that society. And I think the new approaches will move probably away from that and present the lens of moving away from a focus on the local communities by outsiders, and more of it being them looking at, giving them the tools to look at themselves and to understand their problems and find solutions to their problems locally. But then you need to do it on a continuous basis. You can't just go in and come out again. And I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed as well.
So, you know, in your response there, you mentioned one of the recommendations. So maybe that's, you know, an opportune time to kind of pull back the curtain and reveal the recommendations that come out of this. And so that is basically curriculum development and sort of building like a community, developing open source tools and building global awareness. And so, you know, I'd like to maybe go through each of those. You just touched on awareness. Anything else maybe you'd want to add there? Or
yeah, I think with the awareness, this idea of building awareness, the three pillars, as you rightly point out, Matt, the sort of ways that we want to take this forward. I think one of the things we want to do, or one of the things we recommend, is to support this academic to private sector pipeline that Isabel talked about. So in order to kind of foster a cultural shift towards anthropological thinking, to get people thinking anthropologically or using anthropological thinking as a way of understanding problems, a way of approaching problems in new ways. And I think that this, if historically those new ideas or those methodologies have sat in academia, haven't really been applied, we need to follow the example of people like Anders Christian Munk and Sarah Pink and Genevieve Bell and all those people who have applied this into the real world and to solve real world problems. And that is just sort of supporting that academic to private pipeline, which has been kind of, you know, sporadic. I mean, it has happened, but it's not, there's been no concerted effort to promote it, if you like. The other thing was one thing that Isabel touched on, which was about the bringing together the terminology that people use. I mean, people don't even know what anthropology is. If you want to tell the world about anthropology and tell the world why, or show the world why anthropology can help solve societal problems like inequalities and bias and misinformation and all those things which UNESCO are really interested in, you have to be able to say that, you have to find a way of saying of uniting the language, of uniting the way, or giving people the same way of talking about these things. At the moment, those things are really disparate, as Izzy touched on. And I think another part of this idea of raising global awareness is to make sure that let's start thinking, you know, and talking, not just thinking, but talking about off the same hymn sheet, if you like, you know, that use the same terms, because it is confusing. It is confusing. People don't even know what anthropology is. So if you're going to talk to them about digital anthropology or computational anthropology, you've got a lot of learning has to be done. A lot of teaching has to be done. You have to give people the tools to learn what that stuff means. Because we revel in the complexity of anthropology, and it's, we almost celebrate it. And I think that's one of the things I noticed, actually. It's like, well, why? Yeah, okay. We're all very clever, and we've got our masters and our PhDs in whatever part of anthropology it might be. But it means nothing if you can't explain it. If you can't do an elevator test, right, on anthropology, what is digital anthropology? What is anthropology? What does it do? What's it for? If you can't explain that to your grandma and her understand it in the time it takes to come down three floors in an elevator, then you haven't understood it yourself. And I think that we need to be able to have to do that. Anthropology is the study of what it is to be human in human society. There you go. Digital anthropology is the study of what it means to be human in a digitally engaged society. and then to explain what that means to people, and then to explain to them why there's a benefit in doing that. Why there's a benefit in understanding the human aspect of society, not just measurable just by data, but measurable by understanding of human experience. So it's not just the bird's eye view, it's the worm's eye view as well. Okay, and that is what needs to be explained in simple terms that people can apply it. I'll tell you a person who I quite admire for trying to bridge that gap, although she's coming at it from slightly different ways. Gillian Tett, in her book Anthrovision, which has obviously had a lot of traction recently, and most of, I think, of your audience will be aware of that work. But it is an interesting idea, is it not, that you can apply anthropological thinking to the business environment, and to explain what advantages that will give you. If you find out that from Intel, or the Xerox photocopier guys, repair guys, were basically chucking away the manual and doing it, learning from each other as how to solve the problems that they had with photocopiers. And not that, the manual was fine, but it wasn't usable in a way that was properly applicable and properly got the job done. It was about how people actually use those machines and therefore how you could solve those problems. That kind of approach, I think, which Gillian Tett highlights, I think was very, very interesting. It's a nice move towards that idea of creating a language that everybody can understand as to explain why digital anthropology is useful. It is applicable, and it can help solve problems.
Continuing on that thread, in order to have a pipeline, we also need, the academic curriculum. Right. And so what's the recommendation around that?
Well, the fundamental recommendation is that, and there will, I'm sure there will be academic resistance to this, because in academia, people like to sit in their silos, don't they? And this is what I do. And I'm an expert in this. And I got tenure because of my involvement in this. That is admirable, obviously. But I think we would ask that people consider mixed methods, mixed methodologies, combining of big data and thick data approaches to solving anthropological issues. Trialing kind of mixed courses, if you like, at universities. So changing the academic way of thinking about what anthropology is for and how it works. There are examples. There are academic labs and think tanks and around the world which are working in an interdisciplinary kind of fashion. And I think that we could there's a model there that people might find useful in this idea of using mixed methods. This is nothing new. I mean, people have been talking about this for a while. And I think that Sarah Pink said in 2018 it's why the world needs anthropologists. The future of anthropology should be I'm paraphrasing. It should be collaborative. But there is an it should be interventionist. It should be collaborative. But it should be interdisciplinary as well. And I think that if Anders Christian Munk can do it, and his people at Aalborg University can do it, then that's a great model for others to follow. It doesn't work for everybody, but it's one way of going forward. So the shared vocabulary, open access to archives, open access new technologies, open source technologies is another way forward as well. I think anthropology courses in academia could be broader. There will be many people there who will tell me that there are hundreds of examples, and maybe there are. I can't claim to have exhaustive knowledge of the entire academic world of anthropology. But from my own personal experience and from the experience of others around me, a broader involvement of big data and computational techniques would be, along with the academic and theoretical stuff that we do, and then the regular kind of digital the study of the digital via the digital, that would be useful as well. And there will be a new generation of people of researchers who were born out of this kind of liminal space, this doorway, you know, open the doorway between these two, or these disciplines, which have hitherto been kept very much apart, by, you know, for whatever reason, whether good or bad, and open some doors. And so that the new there's a new generation of researchers who may be in sub-Saharan Africa, they may be in, you know, Savannah Valley in Kenya. They're as likely to be there as they are to be in Silicon Valley in California. And I think once you do that, and those people have those tools, and then they are open sourced, you know, tools that UNESCO can help develop, then you start making a real difference. As you said before, from bottom up, locally focused solutions to understanding of the problems that humanity is facing from that perspective. And I think that is probably one of the, that's how the change in academic thinking will help.
I think just quickly to build on that, I think part of welcoming this kind of new generation of mixed methods researchers is maybe about losing the attachment to anthropology and the term anthropology in itself. Maybe it's we're talking about storytelling, or maybe we're talking about humanity, or maybe there's other ways of expressing it, and it could be like hanging on to anthropology and anthropological terms, maybe the thing that is kind of dampering this process.
You, in the report, also talk about a little, like, you know, there's some barriers, and you have a section on foresight. And so maybe we could just kind of tie this all together. What do you see as the maybe the roadblocks, and really what do you see as the opportunity? You know, and under foresight, I'll just add that, you know, you had effective computing, business anthropology, trend prediction, and citizen storytellers, sort of building, you know, on that last point. So
yeah, I think they, well, citizen storytellers is one that we use quite a lot to think about foresight. Trend prediction is something that's happening now. There are companies involved in that, have been for a while. Affective computing is something that we think would be extremely interesting. I claim little knowledge on it, other than that my understanding is that it's the development of systems and devices that can sort of interpret and process and stimulate human affects. That is the instinctive reactions to the situations before the brain kicks in and forms an emotional response. Those technologies are nascent, but they originated in the late 1990s, I think. That can, you know, collecting, you know, using data, collecting algorithms that have empathy built in, I think is quite an interesting idea. So that's an interesting foresight. We couldn't find anyone that was applying affective computing to anthropological questions, but I'm sure somebody is.
It must be out there.
It must be out there. So harnessing that, I think would be a very interesting foresight. This idea also, I mean, more broadly, you know, business anthropology. Yeah, I mean, Matt, you're involved in that. You know probably more about that than we do. But I think it's the I think business anthropology, the applied approach to anthropology is the way forward. Not that there's anything wrong with the academic, the purely academic iteration of the discipline, but it can be more widely applied. You know, whether it's through formally to people like Red Associates, or whether it's through people who are, you know, adopt Gillian Tett's kind of approach and starts employing more anthropologists in their research teams or their, and yeah, and beyond, and I mean that beyond, you know, just product developments and product testing and all that kind of stuff, user experience, to think about, you know, as a way of affecting policy and strategies within organizations. I think that would be an interesting way forward, to move beyond just, you know, not just, but beyond its current application. But I think you're right. There are, and we were talking about trend prediction. I remember the people who are doing it at the moment, people like L'Atelier in Paris, and Black Swan Data in the UK are doing that as well. But there are still barriers. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge that if we talk about this happening globally, then there's a massive disparity globally in digital capabilities, in infrastructure, and all that, you know, the basic, you know, economic stuff, which means that, you know, it's massively expensive accessing data in certain countries compared to the global north. You know, we have it cheap. It may seem like expensive when we see our monthly bill, but as a percentage of our income, it's probably amongst the lowest in the world. If it's more than 2% of your monthly income to access a gig of data, it's considered unaffordable. And most of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, is way above that 2% figure. So there are global disparities in infrastructure, global disparities in funding, global disparities in investment, et cetera, and those are barriers that are always going to hold us back. Because no matter how good the techniques might be, and no matter how good the technologies might be, if people don't have the capacity to access those technologies or to use those technologies or to use those techniques, then it's meaningless. So, and now that's not within the remit of us or UNESCO even to do that. I mean, that's a global economic consideration. So yes, there are barriers, and some of them are, you know, quite large and systemic. Some of them are more local and based on history and are culturally sort of centered. But you know, so it's not going to be plain sailing by any means. But I think if UNESCO are able to, you know, apply these three areas of that they were talking about, which is awareness and the training of new talent in sort of across functional ways, as well as you know, breaking this stranglehold, if you like, that's the global north has on the discipline. I think there's a good chance of this, we can make this work.
And Isabel, anything you want to add to that?
I do feel as if there's something to be learned from anthropologists in Africa. This was something that was really highlighted in the regional report to us, that there is this growing movement in Africa among scholars and also amongst more kind of business-leaning anthropologists of returning the gaze. So that region historically being somewhere where anthropological gaze from the West has been centered. And now there's this increasing and growing movement of returning that gaze back. So the observed becoming the observer. And I think there's something really beautiful there and some really kind of exciting energy to build upon, which could really bring something exciting to innovation within digital anthropology that otherwise has the danger of being overlooked.
Probably a good way to end it. Simon, Isabel, thanks for your time. Thanks for putting together the report. Appreciate everything. And I know that the wider community will enjoy seeing it once it's out.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed for having us. We've really enjoyed talking about it. We're doing the whole process. It's been eye-opening. It's been amazing, and we've absolutely loved it. And if we can get some of that our enthusiasm across in the report, then we've done, you know, what we wanted to do. So thank you very much indeed for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you. And it's something that we absolutely love talking about. So we're always inviting people to talk to us about the report or talk to us anything digital anthropology related. We're just really into kind of nerding out about that kind of stuff. So if you do want to find us, you can type in Digital Behavior Lab on LinkedIn, and that will bring us to your page. You'll see the neon green logo and you'll know that it's us. So drop us a message. We're here to chat. And yeah, hopefully we can bring this future of an anthropological world together.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out the LIV Center at livcenter.org and follow, subscribe, and share to help us spread the news on innovation in digital anthropology. I'm your host, Matt Arts. Until next time.